Nick, give him your wallet.
What for?
He's got a knife.
That's not a knife. That's a knife.
An American reporter meets, then falls for, a legend of the Australian outback. This week, we chat about bidet mishaps, why you should never run down the streets of Manhattan barefoot, and the perfect metaphor for being a Mets fan. James also gets John Lennon to spin in his grave as we find out if Crocodile Dundee stands the test of time.
Test of time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glutton. Alan says as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? Test of time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Test of Time podcast. I'm one of your hosts, James Brief, and with me, as always, is, I guess, my co-host, and I guess you could call the director of the podcast, Alan Noah.
I'll take director, sure. Does that mean that I get to have, like, one of those cool director's chairs, like, with my name on the back?
No, but you're the one who does all the post-production of this show and putting this pretty little podcast together that we have done 200 and how many times now?
This is episode 228.
228. This podcast, I would like to say, has stood the test of time.
Aw, although we're not 15 years old, so I don't know if we're eligible based on our own rules.
That's true as well, but I will say that our 200th episode is better than our first couple episodes. And turning away from the podcast, you know, of course, who Shigeru Miyamoto is, right?
Of course I do. He's the Nintendo legend icon, the man who came up with Mario and Zelda.
Donkey Kong.
Yeah, like all of the big IP that Nintendo is best known for.
Right, and not just like some guy in 1985 that hit three in a row. He was instrumental in some of the biggest sequels of all of these. And his games, when there's a Shigeru Miyamoto directed or produced game, they tend to run late. And he has a famous quote where he says, "A delayed game is eventually good when it's released, but a rushed game released too early is forever bad." And sometimes things need a little more time to be better.
Yes, I think that's true. I think in the era of digital video games, it becomes a little bit easier to patch a game that is released and has a flaw.
PC games, even console games, are notorious for you buy a game and you can't play it because it already has a patch. And you ever heard of a game from a couple years ago called No Man's Sky?
I've heard of it. I don't know anything about it.
Well, it was so hyped. I mean, the things that they told you that you'll be able to do, basically a space simulator, almost like, think of like the Oasis in Ready Player One, but flying around in spaceships, like 10,000 unique planets and all these crazy things. And everyone was so psyched. It broke tons of records when it came out. And the game just wasn't that good. It totally didn't deliver. It didn't deliver on, you know, half the promises. But through patches and updates and, you know, free things that they gave to all the people that bought the game, it actually wound up turning into basically the game that they released. And the people that stuck with it liked it, but it's forever tarnished. And there's a game that's very hotly anticipated called Cyberpunk 2077. Have you heard of this game?
Again, heard of it, but don't know much about it.
It's going to be one of the last huge releases for this generation, but also it's a launch title for the next generation. So it's going to be a system seller, and they just announced a delay and people are all pissed off. But I just always think I trust the people, even if they're pushing past like Christmas sales. Like, I think they know what they're doing.
If a company's going to miss a deadline like the holiday season, they must be doing it for a solid reason. And I think that's
always true, and that's definitely happened with some of those, you know, Miyamoto games, some Zelda games that were supposed to come out for a holiday season and then were pushed to the following spring. But especially now in 2020, like, COVID impacted everything. And yeah, maybe a lot of these coders can work from home and work remotely, and it's fine, but their schedules were impacted. Like, they had to have been, because of course they were. Everything was.
Well, it is going to make, as of the recording of this podcast, it is supposed to make holiday sales, but they're going to miss Black Friday. It's supposed to come out now in mid-December.
Well, what even is Black Friday anymore? I mean, like, this year, what's Black Friday?
That's a fantastic point. I mean, unfortunately, I think Black Friday is going to be as crazy as it usually is. A lot of people are going to risk it because that's the only way, you know, some people might be able to get a 60-inch television. But you're right, it probably will impact things.
I would think so. But while we're talking about Black Friday, that's kind of related to Thanksgiving. Follow me for this segue, but it is the month of November, and November always makes me think of Thanksgiving. And so I had the idea that this November, we should say that we are thankful for our fans, which of course we are. And for the rest of the month, we're going to do movies that were requested by some of our fans. And we're starting with Crocodile Dundee, which was a request from Cody Jones. He requested this movie on Facebook. He also requested War Games. That one we're going to hold off on for a little bit. We'll definitely get to War Games.
Yeah, we have a plan for War Games.
Right. But Cody requested this on Facebook. Next week's episode comes from a request we got on Twitter. And the week after that is a request we got over email. So, you know, at the end of every episode, I always say, tweet at us and email us, and we love hearing from you. And it's true. And we are listening. We are paying attention. Cody, apologies for it taking us a while to get to this movie, but we're doing it because you asked. And let's talk about Crocodile Dundee. So this is a movie about a New York reporter named Sue who interviews an Australian man named Mick Crocodile Dundee. The crocodile is in quotes, as it is in the title of this movie, by the way. It's quotation mark crocodile, end quotation, Dundee. But of course, Crocodile Dundee is played by Paul Hogan. And this man supposedly lost a leg after battling a crocodile and lived to tell about it. But it turns out that he never actually lost a leg, but he is quite resourceful in the Australian wilderness. After Dundee rescues Sue from a crocodile attack, she brings him back with her to New York City. In Manhattan, Dundee finds the city's inhabitants to be even weirder than the creatures he battles back home. Will New York City be too much for this outback man, or can even a wild man like Dundee be tamed? So I do not need to ask you if this was a box office hit, because I know that this was a huge smash hit in 1986. This like blew all expectations away when it came out.
Yes, this movie was a huge hit, but it opened with $8 million. And it went on to make $175 million, more than 20 times its opener, but it never went over $10 million.
Like in a week?
Right. Like, I'm just looking at the entire list of weekends. The first weekend was 8 million. The second weekend was 8.2, then 10.5, then 7, 6, 5, 6, 5, 5, 5. It just goes down from there. But it was in theaters forever. And this movie came out in 1986, September 26, 1986. And this little film, it was $8 million and it grossed $300 million worldwide. For 1986, it was number two in the American box office. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, this was like a little film from Australia. Australia is not known for its huge movie industry, but this just struck a chord with people in America and all over the world, right?
You're exactly right. It was actually number two all over the world. It was number two to the same film. It was number two in America. And we reviewed this film. This is 1986. Can you remember this?
Top Gun.
Correct. This is great. Number three, World and Domestic, were both sequels. And we reviewed both of these 1986 sequels. These are part twos, I'll say, not just sequels. This is a film, I'll give you a hint, that there is a very popular, surprisingly popular, and critically acclaimed miniseries now streaming on Netflix. Or series, I guess.
Oh, Karate Kid. Karate Kid Part 2.
Yeah, I'm talking about Cobra Kai. But also the worldwide was Aliens.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Crocodile Dundee made more money, almost double the money that Aliens made in the worldwide box office. If you add up Aliens and Platoon's box office, you almost get Crocodile Dundee's worldwide box office.
That is kind of bonkers.
Yeah. But with this, we actually have reviewed all five of the top five of 1986. Top Gun, Crocodile Dundee, Karate Kid Part 2, Back to School, and Aliens. This was the domestic box office. So, all right, we've checked off five 1986 big blockbusters.
All right, way to go, us. So let's get into the movie. It starts with Sue, who is this reporter for Newsday, which is a real New York newspaper that still exists today. But she is not in New York. She is in Australia, and she's on the phone to her coworker slash boss slash boyfriend, and she wants to stay in Australia to work on another story. We don't know what the first story she was there for was, but it doesn't really matter. She got wind of this guy who was attacked by a crocodile. His leg was bit off, and he crawled around for a couple of weeks before he got back to society, and he's okay now. This seems like a great idea for a newspaper story to Sue. It doesn't seem like that great of a story to me. Like, I don't really get what the hook is. Like, it's a tale of survival, but I don't know. Do New Yorkers really care about a guy in Australia who survived a crocodile attack?
This is the kind of story that actually seems fantastic maybe for Life magazine, National Geographic, or perhaps a newspaper service that wants to syndicate this story, because it's a cool story that you'll sell to every local newspaper outlet, you know, across the world. But maybe because she's already there, maybe they'll do it, because I don't know, maybe they could syndicate this story. But otherwise, wow, you're going to put your reporter in that much danger? Maybe because it was her idea, they're okay with it?
I don't know. It just kind of felt like a weak premise to start the movie. But she goes to meet this guy at a bar, and he's not there at first. She's talking with his associate, Wally. And when Crocodile Dundee finally does show up, he makes a big entrance because he's holding a crocodile, and he kind of freaks out everyone in the bar, but it's not a real live crocodile. It's already dead, and ha ha ha, isn't that funny? And then Crocodile Dundee apologizes to Sue and immediately asks her to dance because she's a woman, and she's like, yeah, okay, I'll dance with you, which doesn't seem like a great start to their interview process. It's not very journalistic, I would say. But then she's asking about the leg and saying, hey, the story I heard was that you had your leg bit off. And he's like, oh, no, it was just a love bite. He shows her the leg, and it's got a pretty nasty bite there. But yeah, he's definitely not an amputee. The leg is still attached to his body.
Right. I mean, I actually had no problem with him dancing with her, because he's a very, like, he's not a city guy. And it seems like he's probably never been to any city, you know, Australian or whatnot. And you know, he's rough around the edges. And did you notice that the people at the bar are drinking Foster's beer? And, you know, I remember in the 90s, there was a huge campaign trying to convince Americans that, like, all Australians drink Foster's. From what I understand from talking to Australians, that is not true.
Well, it's like Americans and Budweiser or Bud Light. Like, it's the thing that we're known for. It's a common beer, but it's not something that people in the country who really like beer regularly drink, because we know it's crap.
Yeah, but I don't even think it's that comparison. Budweiser is by far, I believe, the number one selling beer in the United States. I mean, that is a very popular beer. I just don't even think Foster's is that popular.
Oh, really?
That's what I thought. I could be wrong. So please, Australians, if it's a really good beer, maybe they turned it around and it's a great beer now. Or maybe it's the number one best-selling beer. I don't know. But I just noticed that there was prominently displayed Foster's because I believe Foster's was trying to introduce this to America, because that's kind of what this film is. This is one of the first like big box office Australian films, you know?
Well, yeah, and it certainly comes across throughout the first half of the movie like this movie is an ad made by the Australia Tourism Board. And the country looks beautiful. There are just a lot of gorgeous vistas, and you're getting these beautiful shots of the outback and everything. And I could see a lot of people walking out of the theater in the 80s saying, man, Australia is beautiful. We should go there. And, you know, not really being bothered about the, oh, yeah, but there's crocodiles and snakes and kangaroo hunters and things like that. I mean, I'm sure you could avoid that on a touristy trip. But this was definitely designed to, I think, make other people in other countries want to say, I want to go to Australia.
Oh, I mean, it's fantastic. The waterfalls, there's a part where they're swimming in one of these places that looks unbelievable. You want to go to this place. And you could do this stuff safely. But in this film, they are walking through the Australian wilderness on foot and they're camping out without tents. I mean, I would be terrified to do either of those things.
Right. And ostensibly, the reason why they're doing this is because they're retracing the steps of what happened to Mick after the crocodile attack. His real name is Michael J. Dundee, but they call him Mick when they don't call him Crocodile. He admits that that name just was made up by his business partner. It's good for the tourists. But he's perfectly comfortable doing this because he has done a walkabout, which is a thing I know from Lost. I think that was what Locke wanted to do when he was in Australia. And it is a real thing where people would just kind of wander around the Australian outback looking for spiritual meaning. He mentions that he was on a walkabout for 18 months and he was married. And when he came back, his wife was gone. But he's doing all of these cool things like getting a buffalo that's like in the middle of the road to kind of just like fall asleep by like moving his fingers at it. It's sort of like when Bart does the touch of death on The Simpsons, just kind of like the thumb and pinky out, just kind of being like, wow. And for whatever reason, it makes the buffalo fall asleep. Like, okay.
Yeah, and I mean, he knows his way by the sun. He catches a snake with his hand. And, you know, he knows exactly what it is, too. He's like, oh, yeah, that's a rattler. It's totally poisonous. Could have killed us. Yeah, totally. And he's really charming, too. Paul Hogan, he's a charming guy.
Right. And he's ruggedly handsome.
And up until this point, I'm thinking, like, this is a totally fun chap without any flaws.
Uh-huh. But he's pretty sexist. At one point, he says that they're going somewhere, and he's like, well, it'll take us an hour to get there, but you, being a Sheila, it'll take two. And Sue seems mildly offended by this, but not really. It's sort of like this thing that kind of goes back and forth with this character, where she is a strong, independent woman who doesn't need a man. And she talks about her ex-husband and the two of them protested all of these things. And she's a real activist, but she really doesn't push back all that much on a lot of the sexist shit that Mick says. When she's talking about her activism, she asks him about what does he think about the nuclear arms race, which was the big issue in the mid-80s. But he's like, eh, I don't know. It doesn't affect me. What does my opinion matter? But then once again, he says something about like, oh, you're just a little city girl and you wouldn't last a day out here. And then she's like, you know what? I'm going to prove you wrong. And she goes off on her own. But like 3 minutes later, she's attacked by a crocodile and Mick has to jump in at the last second and save her. And she's very like, oh, thank you. I was a goner. Oh, you saved me. I am just a little city girl. I do need you to protect me.
I actually really like the part after he rescued her, because I hate parts in films when someone is, you know, near certain death and they're rescued by the hero and they just go, oh, thanks a lot, hero. Let's keep running. And this one, she was almost killed by this crocodile. He rescues her at the last second and she breaks down into hysterics crying. I thought it was actually very good. This actress, Linda Kozlowski, maybe Kozlowski, sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name.
I would guess Kozlowski.
Kozlowski. Yeah, it's probably Kozlowski. Hey, Kozlowski. Yeah, that sounds about right. I think she's a good actress in this film.
I'm not saying she's a bad actress. I'm just saying it's weird that she goes from being the tough feminist to being like the damsel in distress in like 5 seconds.
In this moment, anyone's gonna shit their pants. And that's perfectly fine here. And you know what? I actually have no problem with Mick Dundee saying a sexist remark, because this is the beginning of the film. These are offenses that, okay, he's making these offenses and then he's going to learn things.
Yes, exactly. And we'll see what he learns or doesn't learn as we go on. There's one kind of funny moment where he meets this Aboriginal person and he's wearing a watch and jeans, and there's sort of like this gag about how he's basically a city guy, but he comes home for these, you know, important rituals, and Sue is most definitely not allowed to go to this ritual because she's a woman, but she sneaks over anyway and takes some pictures. And then Mick is like, well, I knew you were going to show up because you're a woman and a reporter. So you're the biggest busybody in the world. Busybody, I think, is a word that doesn't really stand the test of time. But she just kind of rolls with all the sexist shit.
You know, I will give Mick credit for one thing here. The Aboriginals, who are, they're the people that were in Australia before the British colonists, imperialism, or whatever you want to call it. Before, you know.
The white man showed up.
Yes, exactly. Sue asks him, what is your thought on this, on Aboriginal land owning versus, you know, Australian land owning? And, you know, I don't know anything about it, but I'm just going to guess that it's something to do with someone asking, what do you say about, you know, Native Americans wanting to have land back. I'm just going to guess, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's probably a similar argument. And I at least give credit that I like his answer. It wasn't political at all. And he's like, look, you know, it's nobody's land. Like, the land was here before the Aboriginals. It's going to be here a long time after us. Owning, not owning, like, I don't have even a sense of this. And again, this is the beginning when this guy just kind of lives in wherever. And I did like that answer. It was a very John Lennon answer. Like, imagine there's no countries. It's easy if you try.
That's a stretch.
I mean, he obviously was giving a very, like, you know, there is no, like, owning land. I thought it was a John Lennon kind of answer. So I just thought it's interesting in 1986, the, like, these really noble qualities and, dare I say, you know, progressive qualities that he's expressing, but others that he isn't.
Wait, do you hear that sound? Do you hear that scratching sound?
No. Let me take my headphones off.
It's probably just a John Lennon spinning in his grave. That must be what it is.
I didn't say that the dialogue.
No, it's fine. No. Just compare one of the greatest songwriters to ever live with Crocodile Dundee. Okay,
I did compare it. That's right. I did compare it. I compared. It's called a comparison.
Well, if anyone heard that sound, that's what that sound was. But meanwhile, throughout all of this, Sue is falling for Mick, and they kiss, and she invites him back to New York, and he's like, I don't know. And he mentions it to Wally, and Wally's like, all the way to New York? This seems weird. And then Sue's like, my newspaper will pay for it. And then everyone's like, yeah, okay, sure. We find out later that not only is Sue's boyfriend her boss, but also her father owns the newspaper. So I guess that's why she's so confident that they'll foot the bill. And once they get to New York, there are some funny moments where now Mick is the fish out of water before Sue was the fish out of water. But he gets to the airport and he doesn't know how escalators work. Wacky! But then, like, he just kind of realizes, oh, no, I just have to step over it at the bottom and it's fine and it's not going to suck me in. I don't know. Like, I remember that gag being really funny from when I saw this movie as a kid. And now I was just like, oh, he just kind of figures it out in like 2 seconds.
And to be fair, you thought it was hysterical several weeks ago in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure when Ted says, hey, Socrates, watch out for your robe as he's getting off the escalator. You're not against an escalator gag.
No, but that was funny because the robe could get caught. It's just less funny of like, oh, I'm going to get caught? Oh, no. Oh, wait. No, I won't. It'll be fine.
I admit that was not a funny gag. Something I really did like was, and I think this goes to Paul Hogan's charm. I love when he first gets to New York and he just says like, good day to everyone. And he says hello to everyone he meets. Even when the cab comes to a stop and he says good day to the people at the corner. And remember, this is 1986 New York. So Hollywood depicts it as it's an urban hellhole with maybe some nice parts in it too.
Apparently, Paul Hogan, in real life, the first time he came to New York, he was saying good day to everyone. We also have to mention that the cab driver is Reginald Vell Johnson, a.k.a. Officer Winslow from Family Matters, a.k.a. the cop from Die Hard and Die Hard 2, Die Harder. Not in any of the other subsequent Die Hard movies, but always nice to see him. And so Sue brings Mick to the hotel where he's staying, and he is very perplexed by the sight of the bidet in the bathroom. I remember watching this movie as a kid and not getting that joke because I don't think I'd ever seen a bidet in my life at that point. But it made me laugh thinking of you, James, because you have a bidet in your apartment, and they've kind of become like a trendy thing now. I feel like on a lot of podcasts I listen to, there's always those ads for Tushy. Actually, we should get them to sponsor our show.
It's just something that there's been really no advancement on the toilet. I'd guess probably the 50s for the most part. So yes, bidets are pretty cool.
The funny thing about the fact that you have a bidet is that at Nick's Marathon, usually, not this year, but there's normally a lot of kids in your apartment, and it's happened twice now where a little kid goes into your bathroom and thinks he's flushing, but he turns on the bidet, and then water goes shooting out of your bathroom and gets everywhere, and everyone's like, oh my god, what's happening? Is the ceiling leaking? Oh no, it's just water shooting from the bidet, and it's pretty funny when that happens.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. There is a small missing part of my paint where the bidet shot up. But that'll be patched up.
It's always little kids who do it and then they feel bad and it's just cute.
Oh, yeah. At first they're scared that everyone starts laughing. So then I believe there's one kid that tried to turn it on again to elicit this laughter. We had to be like, no. So, But I agree. A bidet joke in America will not really be a big hit because most people have no idea what it is. One joke that was funny was they show him a television. I love seeing state-of-the-art televisions in 1986, which are, I guess you'd probably call them like 25-inch TVs, maybe.
Maybe
that's as big as the screen is. And he's like, oh, yeah, I saw a television once, like a long time ago. And he turns it on, and it's an episode of I Love Lucy. And he's like, oh, yeah, I already saw this. I think that joke, knowing the context and knowing it's 1986 to like 1956, that joke like still hits. but I don't necessarily think anyone would understand why that joke is funny today.
Right. Yeah, it's not a great gag.
It didn't age well. I think it is a good gag in 1986.
Okay, yeah, fine. I'll grant you that. But while Mick is in New York, Sue invites her out with her boyfriend, and there's this love triangle that's set up, but they don't do anything with it. Like, at no point does Sue ever say to Mick, hey, I have feelings for you, but I do have my boyfriend, and he's a little bit more stable, but I still want you to go out with us, or anything like that. She never says to the boyfriend, hey, I kind of have feelings for Mick, but let's try to get along. Like, there's just no communication about it. It kind of makes her seem, like, awful that she's leading on both of them. But the boyfriend is drunk at dinner. He showed up early to get to the bar, and he's being obnoxious to Mick. So Mick punches him or, like, headbutts him. I wasn't quite sure which he did, but, like, while they're sitting at the restaurant, and then they have to leave, and Sue's like, you shouldn't hit him. We're not in the Outback. And he's like, yeah, but he was being a jerk. And she's like, yes, but that still doesn't mean you punch people in a fancy Italian restaurant.
Once again, yeah, this is how he does it back home. He punches someone in the face. And now he has a perfect opportunity to go, oh, maybe I could do something else. And if it comes to it, punch them, certainly. But maybe that's not the first thing. I mean, the guy didn't do anything violent. And the guy, like, knocked him unconscious.
Yeah, yeah. So after dinner at the restaurant, Mick goes out with his taxi driver because he's like, hey, you want to go get a beer? And the taxi driver's like, yeah, sure. Why not? My shift's over. So they go to a bar, and Mick is talking with this young woman, and she's flirting very heavily with him. And then the taxi driver is like, no, 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 that's not a woman. That's a man.
To be fair, in the Australian Outback, I could be wrong, in his small area, it's very possible this guy has never seen what we today would call a transgendered person. It's perfectly fine for him to be, you know, confused by this, but I certainly did not remember this part of the film.
Oh, yeah, it's bad. I mean, he just grabs this woman's crotch and then screams loudly, yeah, you are a guy. And then everyone laughs, and that's it. There's no lessons learned later that, like, you shouldn't have done that. In fact, later on, he does that to someone else he meets, and that woman is like, oh, my. And then Sue is like, oh, don't mind him. He's from Australia. And she's like, well, I should go to Australia then. Like, it's okay to just go up to people and grab their crotch. That's basically Mick's lesson.
Again, he's a fish out of water story. All of these things he's doing wrong is actually a very easy way to teach the audience morals of what's wrong, but he never learns the lesson of these things.
Right, exactly right.
You know, the first time I heard him say something really sexist to Sue, I really was waiting for the payoff that just really doesn't happen.
No.
However, the next scene, probably the most famous scene in the film, I think that this scene still totally holds up. It's a scene when they're walking around at night, and again, this is Manhattan in the 80s, which is a fuck you and, you know, an urban hellhole kind of place. They're walking around, and some guy who looks like he's an extra from, I think, like the Beat It video, he comes up, pulls up a switchblade. He's like, give me your knife. And Sue is like, oh my God, just give him your wallet. The punchline is of course, you know, when the guy's holding this switchblade, that Mick Dundee says, that's not a knife. And he pulls out this huge, like, you know, it's a, what we would call a Rambo knife or
a Bowie knife, right?
It's a small machete, this thing. It's terrifying. And he is so confident holding it. And he also actually cuts the guy's red leather jacket. And they all run away. And this is exactly what the fish out of water kind of stuff should be. And this scene I thought was still just as charming as it was.
Yeah, this is the movie's most memorable line. And it was famously parodied on The Simpsons when they go to Australia. You want to just play that clip?
Oh, yeah.
You call that a knife? This is a knife.
That's not a knife, that's a spoon.
All right, you win. I see you've played knifey-spoony before.
In the movie, that's one of the fish-out-of-water gags that really lands. But there's a lot more that don't land. There's a thing about a guy's doing cocaine, and Mick thinks that he just needs to, like, breathe in vapor to clear out his sinuses.
You know, he has no idea what cocaine is. I thought that that's totally a good idea for a joke. I just didn't really think that that particular joke was funny, what he did with it.
It's not that funny. Then they're at another dinner party, and there's a conversation about talking to a shrink, and it goes on way too long. But the joke is that, well, she was having some problems, but then she talked to a shrink, and now she's doing better. And for Mick, that's insane. You know, where I come from, if you have a problem, you tell it to Wally, and then he'll tell everyone, and then you don't have a problem anymore. Psychiatry. How crazy. Eye roll. And, I mean, that joke definitely doesn't stand the test of time. It's just hard for me to imagine that having been really funny in 1986. But, I mean, I guess the movie was insanely popular, so maybe I'm wrong.
I could forgive a joke that takes a shot at psychiatry. You know, that's their take on it. Fine. Mick Dundee doesn't believe in it. It's just not funny.
Right.
You know, this scene here at this dinner party, this film is released in 1986, but there's a film that we reviewed that was released in 1987 that has a very similar plot line here.
I know exactly what you're talking about. You're talking about Coming to America, right?
Exactly, because the fish out of water, you know, not Prince Hakim, in this case, it's, you know, Mick Dundee, he's now in America, Manhattan instead of Queens, and he's finally at this fancy dinner party where the girl that he's found that he really likes is there, but the boyfriend is also there, and the father is a very important person in their life, and even employs them, and then suddenly the boyfriend, who actually is a douche in both films, the boyfriend decides to do an incredibly sexist move and calls everyone's attention and publicly asks this poor girl for marriage in a way that she almost like can't say no.
That's true. She doesn't say yes. Technically, she doesn't say yes. She allows him to put the ring on her finger, but she never says yes. And then Mick is upset. He leaves and he goes out with the driver, Reginald Vell Johnson. There's a fight scene where he bumps into a pimp. He bumped into this pimp earlier. Again, a fish out of water gag because he doesn't know what prostitutes and pimps are. He bumps into this pimp again and the pimp has a couple of friends and are like kind of beating up Crocodile Dundee. But Reginald Vell Johnson saves the day and throws that thing that's on the back of cars that looks like a boomerang at one of the bad guys. And it's just kind of funny that there's a boomerang that is thrown in this movie called Crocodile Dundee, and it's not by the Australian, it's by an American guy.
Yeah, I mean, that part was fine. I like that Reginald Vell Johnson kind of saves the day. I think you and I are a little biased because, like, every scene he's in there, we're like, there's Reginald Vell Johnson. And, you know, we're just happy to see him. And I'm happy he saved the day and I'm happy he threw the boomerang. And I'm totally fine with that scene.
Yeah, it's fine. But then basically Mick is like, well, I have no reason to stay here. I'm going to do a walkabout, except this time he's going to do a walkabout through America. Okay, that's in character. He asks the guy at the hotel like where he should go, and the bellman directs him to the subway. He heads down there, and just a few minutes later, Sue shows up, and she decides that she has to go after him. She's running down the street, and it's taking her too long because she's wearing her heels,
and God.
She takes off her heels and runs barefoot through the streets of Manhattan and then into a subway station.
Yes.
I cannot put into words how unbelievably, horrifically disgusting that is on every level. And I'm not saying that as like a New York City is gross and dirty kind of a way. I love New York City. It's a little dirty, but whatever. But barefoot on the street? No. barefoot in a subway station? You've got to be kidding me.
You know, let's not mince words here. Let's talk about where she was. She was on, it looks like she was on like Central Park, like on the east side of Central Park, right?
I thought west side. I thought she's over by like Columbus Circle.
Okay, maybe the west side, because I see the wall of Central Park. That is a nice area. But that sidewalk is probably covered in a river of dried urine, dog urine. Wouldn't you? That's correct, right?
I like that you said dog. I mean, maybe mostly dog.
Yeah, mostly dog urine and other fluids. And like on the sidewalks, there will be glass. There will be like
garbage, slime.
Yes, I'm glad you saw the exact same thing I was seeing. And I like the symbolism of she takes off her high heels because she's got to, you know, run fast enough to get this guy that she loves. But it should have been maybe she like goes like Mick Dundee and just like snaps off the heels and now, you know, they're flats. And, you know, that would make sense.
Right.
But it's very accurate that if you go to the subway at rush hour, it is wall to wall people. And I will say that I absolutely love this scene. And I think that this scene has a fantastic crescendo of the music, starting out low. And over the course of this scene, it very slowly builds up the music. And Sue's at the bottom of the staircase, getting down to the platform. And she sees Mick because you recognize his hat on the other side of the platform. But she can't contact him because she's too far away. So she screams, "Hey, buddy, get the guy in the hat." So they start like a three-person telephone of, "Yeah, you, construction guy hat. I'm talking about the girl here. Get the guy in the crocodile hat." And so they start a really fun game of telephone.
Yeah, and it's cute because she's saying, "I'm not going to marry Richard. I love you." And all of these guys are screaming it down the subway platform, "I love you." It's cute.
Oh, Al, come on.
But there's nothing, there's absolutely no turning point for Sue where she decides that she loves him, where she realizes that she loves him.
That is fair. That scene should have been before this scene. But yes, I'm talking about just this scene. The scene in the romantic comedy where they run past the security at the airport to meet at the gate or whatever it is they have to do. That part, you don't have to explain the love part. They don't totally explain why she won't marry. Well, we know why she shouldn't marry Richard. But we don't know why she totally has to marry Mick Dundee. That I give you. But come on, Al, this scene is awesome.
It's fine, but you need that other scene to make this scene more awesome, to make it
I'll
mean
that.
Something.
That's true.
But he decides that, okay, he will go back to Sue and he can't get through the sea of people. So he lifts himself up and then starts walking on everybody's head, shoulders. You sort of get the sense that he's not like hurting people, that they're kind of lifting him and guiding him forward. I did happen to catch one guy whose head he really just like steps right on, and the guy's wearing a Mets hat. And I mean, just as a Mets fan, of course, that's the guy who gets like really like legitimately stepped on, the Mets fan.
I don't know, Al. This film came out on September 26th, 1986. Do you want to educate the folks about what's going on in the world at this time?
Sure. The 86 Mets are going to win the World Series this year. But as a metaphor for Mets fans getting crushed by the weight of something from above, I mean, that does stand the test of time, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, after the 86 Mets, I mean, it's been 34 years since then. It must have had a couple more championships, right, Al? Right? Because I know the Yankees have won, like, I don't know how many. So, you know, the Mets have almost as high a payroll.
Right. Even if they've won half as many as the Yankees. Yeah, they've won zero. Maybe that's it. Maybe this was the curse. Crocodile Dundee stepping on that guy's head.
And then the film ends with them embracing and kissing, and ends on your favorite way to end a film, a freeze frame. I'm kidding, of course. It would probably be a freeze frame with voiceover being your least favorite, but this one is just a freeze frame. However, it's not a freeze frame of him kissing Sue. It's a freeze frame of him shaking some random subway guy's hand. It's really odd.
It is. It is an odd way to end the movie. But we have come to the end. And so, James, I will ask you that thing I always ask you. Do you think this movie stands the test of time?
I'm going to say a couple things I really like about this film. And some things I don't like about this film. One, I like the acting in the film of the main characters. I like Paul Hogan. I think he's very charming. I think he plays the character well. I think Sue is very good. I generally like the plot. I'll say that this really is two films. There is the first half of the film is, you know, an outback film in Australia. And the second half of the film is your fish out of water in New York City. And I have to say that the second half of the film is so much more interesting than the first half of the film. I kind of was a little bit bored. I mean, I get you have to show how good he is in the wilderness, but I think it could have been 15 minutes, 20 minutes or something. And I thought it really went on and on. You know, but once he gets to New York City, I think the film really takes off. And, you know, there's some gags that don't hold up. Not hold up, they're just not funny. I agree with you, the escalators are not funny. I do like these little charming things. He's in like what looks like the Waldorf Astoria, but he's sleeping on the floor and he puts his huge Rambo knife into the wall to make a clothesline for his underwear. And I love the scene of when he mugs the guy and that's not a knife, this is a knife. The dinner party, it has its moments where he's able to tame the dogs, these Dobermans outside. And I like that because he's a sweet guy. And you can almost think that, you know, if a dog likes you, you might be a real good guy. Dogs have a good sense of this stuff. And I love the final scene. Like I said, I think that scene is by itself nearly perfect, except maybe they could have stepped on a guy with a Yankees hat. That would have been better.
Right.
But here's what I don't like about this film. He is a rough around the edges guy. He's sexist, and I'm okay with that if he is a character that's going to evolve. I think this is great because he's, in the beginning, he's just a big macho guy and he does all this stuff wrong. And even the transgendered thing, I think the first time he grabs someone to be told it's wrong and then someone else tries to do it, maybe he beats someone else up who tries to make fun of a transgender now that he learns about this. Like, I'd be totally fine with that. I'd forgive the first time he did it because he didn't know. And you know, it's weirdly, he doesn't evolve on that. He evolves on maybe I should have a stance on the nuclear arms race. Like, that's a weird thing to evolve. And he mentions at the very end of the film, I think I'm going to go on a walkabout around America. And I'm thinking, that actually sounds like a fantastic film. But by the end, he's, you know, he's tied to Sue, who I agree with you. There's no real compelling reason why he loves her.
Or why she loves him.
You know, that leads me to really question, like, how did this film amassed such a huge box office, you know, not just in America. Why did the world fall in love with this film?
Good question.
I have to say that if I'm being honest, I think it's going to be one of these things that it really is the test of time. I mean, we were so young when this came out, but would I have laughed at these jokes and not found them offensive? It's possible. In 2020, it's just so obvious that this is such a wrong thing. But this film, it's a guy who's sexist and he's a pig and he grabs his one, but he never learns anything. It's this rough around the edges, but he's actually not rough around the edges. It turns out he's actually just rough. There's not, like, you don't polish it off and you find, like, this completely charming guy who's got all the charm of the Australian wilderness and all the, you know, the talents of that. But now we've taught him that, no, women are equal. And it's so close. And I'm going to end on this. Do you remember, like, 2 years ago, there was an unbelievable, what turned out to be an April Fool's joke or some kind of, I think it was like, it was an Australian, like, tourism commercial or something.
Yeah, for the Super Bowl.
Right. And they made a fake trailer for Danny McBride as Crocodile Dundee in some kind of remake.
No, it was a sequel. He plays Crocodile Dundee's long-lost kid. And the joke is that Chris Hemsworth is like his driver. And it's like a gag in real life that why wouldn't you make Hemsworth Dundee Jr.? And then in the trailer, Hemsworth is like, wait, you're a Crocodile Dundee Jr.? You? Really? Really? You? You? Really? And that's like 45 seconds of the trailer.
Well, I don't remember that part of Chris Hemsworth, but just Danny McBride alone, this is an unbelievable idea for a remake of this film, because Danny McBride's disgusting and he'll be piggish. But Danny McBride's actually a pretty decent actor if you've seen some of the stuff he's done on HBO.
I love him. Love him.
And I could totally see him having a scene, perhaps a little over sappy, but there would be a scene where he would learn. And, you know, then he would also be crass and kick the bad guy in the balls. Like, I can kick that guy in the balls, right? You know, something like that. Like, this film just, I understand why people liked it. Unfortunately, people didn't see this as offensive. And I have enough confidence in people today that this exact same film would not be able to have the success, nearly the success that any success, I'd say. It's a perfect example of this film, while incredibly charming in a lot of ways, it just doesn't stand the test of time. So, charming film and ripe for a remake, but no, I don't think this film holds up. What do you think, Al?
I agree with you. If the movie starts out with Crocodile Dundee as a sexist, ignorant jerk, but he learns a lesson, okay, fine, cool. But he never learns anything. The audience doesn't learn anything through him. It's just a lot of bad gags.
Some good gags.
The offensive jokes aren't funny, and the non-offensive jokes also aren't funny. Like, very little in this movie lands. I think there's more of the fish out of water jokes that are funnier actually in the first half. And I do agree with you that the first half, when they're in Australia, is slower and is more boring. But really, the only gag that kind of made me like chuckle was when Mick is shaving with like a regular razor that you or I would use. And then when he sees Sue coming over, he switches to the Bowie knife. And he's clearly just doing that to impress her. That I was like, okay, that's pretty funny. He's not backwards wilderness guy, really. He's just playing that up for her. Really, honestly, that was the only joke that made me laugh. All of the fish out of water Manhattan stuff just doesn't land. It's not funny. And I will admit that I was kind of thinking, hey, maybe we should also talk about Crocodile Dundee 2 next week, right? Maybe? After watching this movie, like, no. I have zero interest to watch Crocodile Dundee 2. Negative amount of interest to watch Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles. An unbelievable amount of interest to watch that fake Danny McBride version, because I would literally watch a movie where Danny McBride reads the phone book. I love him so much. But it is shocking how unbelievably popular this movie was in 1986. I really don't think it's a good movie. It's not funny. It's not exciting. It's offensive in a stupid way. No, it does not stand the test of time. And I will say, I feel a little bit bad saying this because the whole reason we're talking about it is because one of the fans of the show requested us to talk about it. And Cody, if you really love this movie and we just shat all over it for this entire episode, sorry. I think we've presented our points in a reasonable way. So hopefully you won't hold it against us too much and, you know, unsubscribe and tell us that we suck. But if you do, that's okay.
Well, then again, I said this film is incredibly charming in many ways, but in 2020, this is not the guy that you rooted for. But if I can make one request of screenwriters, please, this is not an offensive joke. This is not a test of time joke. I'm begging you, please, can you stop the joke where a bellboy brings people to a hotel suite and then waits there for their tip, and someone is a little bit oblivious to giving them a tip? It is never funny, ever.
Was it? Like, did that used to be hilarious? Like, in the 80s?
I don't know. And movies that I love, Superman 2 has it. It's not funny. There could possibly be, you know, a spoof Austin Powers kind of take on it where you do something funny and you talk about how stupid this joke is. I absolutely hate that joke, and that's in this film. It doesn't stand the test of time because it was never funny.
Right. I did also just kind of mention this earlier, but like the whole love story doesn't make any sense. There's something there, but they just don't connect any of the dots, and it just doesn't work as a rom-com or a comedy.
It's very interesting that you say that there's something there, but you're talking about the movie not working. They have a lot of chemistry, and they did get married.
I actually don't think they have any on-screen chemistry. I do know that they got married, but like, I don't really buy their on-screen chemistry that much.
I thought that there was chemistry, but there's one last thing I want to say about Sue's character, and she has incredibly 80s hair and mid-80s hair, so to me, her hair combined with her fashion, she could be anywhere from 26 to 45. You know, it's just this 80s hair that I think it's awful. And there's one scene in Australia when they had gone swimming in some lagoon and her hair is wet. So it looks, I guess, more modern, I guess you could call it. And I thought she looked so much better than this 80s hair. Just, it's probably my least favorite of any standard hairdo of any decade for probably men and women.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That's gonna do it for us this week. Thank you, Cody Jones, for suggesting that we watch this movie. Sorry that I hated it, and James agreed that it doesn't stand the test of time. But come back next week for another movie that we are doing by request. This one was requested on Twitter by Michelle D, who talks to us a lot on Twitter. Hi, Michelle. You requested ages ago that we talk about The Outsiders. Well, next week we are finally going to watch The Outsiders, so stay tuned for that. We're doing the fan requests all November long, and that is just the proof that we need you to talk to us at Test of Time Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or email us at thetestoftimepodcast@gmail.com. If you really want to be a super fan, you'll leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts. Hint, hint.
The fans are requesting we talk about space.
No.
All the time on the podcast.
No. See you next time, everybody.
Bye.